Hi, I'm Andrew.
And I'm Spencer.
And we're here at the Slowdown's New York headquarters. You're listening to Time Sensitive, a podcast where we profile curious and courageous people in business, the arts, and beyond who have a distinct perspective on time.
Andrew, this week you had Newton Thomas Siegel, the acclaimed cinematographer, in the studio. He's worked on films like The Usual Suspects, Valkyrie, the X-Men franchise.
Those are the three Bryan Singer films he did. Yeah, but he also, I mean, what's amazing about Tom is, of course, he's well known for Three Kings and most recently Bohemian Rhapsody. Mm. He had just come back from The Five Bloods, the new Spike Lee movie, where he was in Southeast Asia shooting for several months. Hadn't really been home in a couple of years after Bohemian Rhapsody, and he went right into this. Tom and I are old friends. We've worked together a lot. We both had little kids the same time, even though he's a bit older than me. We really connected in that way early on. He's just an incredibly daring, brilliant guy who has led a life that has pushed him into a lot of different areas. I mean, his start was as a kind of Whitney fellow. He was a painter in New York. That's what brought him to New York. He was the first person to ever film the Contras and the Sandinistas and broke a story on CBS.
Wow. So sort of like painter, journalist to cinematographer.
Yeah. I mean, he's just told stories and figured out how to tell stories through images for a long time and has a really deep understanding of how you express human emotion with the tools of light and speed and time and
visceral filmmaking.
For sure. I mean, I think everyone remembers what it was like to watch Three Kings. So yeah, it was a real treat. You know, we never really get to see each other in recent years because he's been traveling so much. And it was so funny because I reached out to him and I said, I really want to get you on the podcast. When are you going to be in New York? And he said, I have no plans. I can't imagine the next time I'm going to be in New York. 24 hours later, he said, I have a shoot in New York in 3 days. Do you have time? And that's how we got the episode done. So
I'm glad it worked out.
A real ruse. Yeah, I'm excited about this one.
So here's Andrew and Tom.
Today on Time Sensitive, we have Tom Siegel in the studio. Tom is a legendary cinematographer. His work on The Usual Suspects, Three Kings, the X-Men films, Drive, and most recently Bohemian Rhapsody have helped to shape cinematic history. Welcome to the studio, Tom. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, no. Thanks for inviting me.
How lucky that we're in the same place at the same time to talk.
How rare.
You winced a little bit when I mentioned your legendary status in cinema.
Some people are legends in their own mind, you know, so.
You are not.
Yeah. And actually, you only get to be a legend by being really old.
You just got back from Southeast Asia. You were working on The Five Bloods with Spike Lee. Tell me a little bit about that. I actually haven't spoken to you since you started that, so this is all fresh.
I know. It's really weird. I haven't seen you in so long, and like, we have microphones.
Doing something formal.
Yeah.
But I like that.
But, yeah, no, I've known Spike Lee for quite a while from doing little commercial work with him. And obviously, speaking of legends, there's really not too many legends in the filmmaking world bigger than Spike Lee. So I'd never done a film with him before. And it was amazing that over the holiday, he called me and he asked if I wanted to do this project. And I was already on another movie and really wasn't finishing on time. So initially I had to say, oh, you know, I'm so sorry, but I'll never be able to be ready in time to properly prep this movie. And I remember Spike saying to me, well, you know, you're a veteran. You'll be fine. And I was like, well, no. I mean, my prep start date would be a week before I've even finished on this show. And I was already in Southeast Asia. But he talked me into it, and so I literally finished a movie for the Russo brothers one night and started Spike's movie the next day.
Wow.
Which was an interesting experience. But Spike is extraordinarily singular talent and personality, very complex, and in a funny way, slightly enigmatic figure. And so it was a great ride. It really was.
And how was being in Vietnam for so many months?
Vietnam, well, we were in Thailand and Vietnam, and Vietnam was amazing. I mean, you know, I grew up with Vietnam, and the name Vietnam was almost like a cultural signpost. You know, when I think of France, the Belgian Congo, Venezuela, I can, you know, any country you can put out and you know about it means, but when you say Vietnam, Vietnam has a meaning that goes so far beyond a place and a nation in my upbringing and in the history of my upbringing. So having said that, it was fascinating to be there and really to try to get a handle on where it's at today and where it's going and the complexities of this place that is both still, you know, controlled, centralized, political, supposedly communist structure, and yet virulently capitalistic in its desire to be like, you know, the next juggernaut in Asia, economic juggernaut. So it's a really interesting mix, not without its perils.
And how is it to be back in the States at this particular time?
Well, you know, between the previous movie, which was called DACA, and Spike's movie, and finishing Bohemian Rhapsody, I was gone for almost a year.
Yeah.
With a few little, you know, home for Christmas and that kind of stuff. So it's interesting. I do have to say, when I got back, it was a little bit of like, oh, everybody's speaking English. And it was definitely some culture shock.
Well, for some people, the sort of bubble of production shields them from reality. There's this phenomenon that all filmmakers deal with on some level. And you're sort of given the space to leave the world for a while and enter this other kind of reality. But then you have to re-enter. How has that kind of been in your life, this re-entry process? Have you gotten better at it? What are your thoughts on it?
You know, filmmaking is a really interesting thing, especially feature filmmaking, in that it's like the perfect life. You are given a place to live. Somebody comes and cleans it while you're at work. You have room service if you're hungry. They give you a car to drive, or somebody drives you someplace. They give you a piece of paper that says, wake up at this time, and this is what you're going to do. And you have a family. They hire a family for you, whether you like them or not.
Kind of a child.
Whether you like them or not. So it's a not only is the thing you're doing fiction, but the entire structure of your life, especially because most of what I do on the road. So your entire life is a fiction as well. And a very easy one, that if you're focused on your work, the rest of it is taken care of. But I love to travel and I love to experience the world, and I started in documentary. So for me, those opportunities are the ones that make you a better person and make you grow and a more responsible citizen. So you have to kind of push yourself rather than just passing out and collapsing when you have a day or two off. You go out and you experience the environment in the world that you're in, and you make relationships with the people that you're working with in those environments, however temporary it might be. So I find that process fun, fascinating, invigorating. But you're right, when you come back, everything is different. And now, you know, I have young children and I've been gone for a while. I come back, I've missed all this great time. I'm a bit of a satellite in the home, you know, trying to remember where the silverware is kept and things like that. And it's both liberating, and that time you have with your children is so precious because it never comes back. And yet at the same time, it's a lot more, you know, challenging.
It helps when you have a partner like the one you have.
I'm very lucky. I'm very lucky. But, you know, it's funny because what I do, and when you're directing, it's even worse. You're being asked so many questions, you know. What lens do you want, you know? Do you want to start this way in the morning or the other way? So there's a million questions you get asked minute by minute. And I find when I come home and where would you like to go for dinner is a vexing question because I really don't want to think about it. I don't want to make any decisions.
And you also have to be careful about in the reentry of like being the boss again.
Yes.
You kind of have to earn that back.
And you have to remember that you can't say things like, okay, lose the dishes. You actually have to get up and pick them up and carry them to the counter.
You can't art direct your home.
You can't. I can't art direct my home because my wife does.
So we all mark time in kind of different ways. Do you find that you, when looking back on the history of your own life, it's marked in the films that you've made?
It's a very sad thing, but since they invented this IMDb thing, the main thing I use it for is to remember time because it's literally like a linear demarcation of my life. I mean, it's if you look at it, it's just a series of titles. But for me, they represent, oh, yeah, it's when we were in Berlin and the kids were still in the cribs. So when I like meet someone, they say, oh, yeah, you know, I worked with you on or I met you or do you remember when we were in? I kind of know where that was in my life time wise by this relatively linear filmography. It sounds fairly pathetic. And
well, there hasn't been much space between the projects.
Well, I've, you know, decided a while ago that I would begin to do commercials in between movies so that I could be a little more picky about what movies I take, so that I could spend more time with my family. So my life tends to be one movie a year and then filling the time in between with commercials.
But before you made films, commercials, raised children, you were a kid.
Yes.
In Detroit.
It's crazy.
And do you remember as a kid being sensitive to imagery, being drawn to imagery in any way?
Well, I was really into, I played a lot of sports when I was little and I drew a lot, but every kid draws a lot. So when I look back at it, I think, oh yeah, I used to draw a lot, but I don't think it was like one of those, yeah, you know, since I was in nursery school, I was drawing on the back of the blackboard or something. I think it's really somewhere around high school, I started to paint and I got my very first job when I was, I think, 14 in a record store. And I saved my money and bought a little Super 8 camera. I had an older brother that was a photographer at the time. And like a lot of brother relationships, I idolized him and I hated him because, you know, he's older, so he beat me up. So I think I emulated him in a way because he was a photographer, but I'm not going to just copy my brother.
Right.
So I got a Super 8 camera and right. I started making little movies.
You one-upped him. You made moving pictures.
And I started that when I was around 14. And they were, this was really at the height of, or the blossoming of what was called either the avant-garde cinema or experimental cinema or personal cinema or independent cinema. It had all these different names. But, you know, we're talking about the 60s, the 70s, and things like anthology film archives were blooming. And filmmakers like Kenneth Anger and Stan Brakhage were out there doing these non-narrative.
You were aware of Brakhage's work.
I became aware of them at the end of high school and right after I got out of high school, much to my parents' chagrin, because they were both academics, I didn't apply for college and they were horrified. But at the University of Buffalo, because we moved from Detroit to Buffalo right at in the middle of my high school years, there was a man named Jerry O'Grady, who was in the English department, but was a champion of this type of filmmaking and was trying to start a film program at the University of Buffalo. Film programs in those days existed at, UCLA, USC, and NYU.
Right.
And not much more. There were some just beginning little ones in, you know, a few other places. So he was trying to start one in Buffalo, and he started a thing called Media Study, which was outside of the school, although tangentially related to it. It was in a storefront, and it was giving community classes. It was meant to, and to teach people how to make movies, and also to bring in these filmmakers like Hollis Frampton to show a movie and have a discussion. So he got the storefront. He hired myself and a fellow named Jeff Slotnick. We each got $50 a week, which was pretty great. And we painted the place. We built in a theater. We built a room with for camera equipment, of which I knew how to use none. So before it officially opened, I had to sit in there and read all the manuals and figure out. There was one 16-millimeter camera, which was the Cadillac, that you had to be really special to get to use that. And this was the very beginnings of video, where we had what they called the Portapak, the black and white video camera attached by a cable to a giant recorder that, you know, created these like really awful images on half inch videotape. So that was my first job outside of, you know, in film. And that's where I met Kenneth Anger, who came and he was one of the guest lecturers and showed his films. And he was starting a movie called Lucifer Rising. And he asked me if I would shoot some stuff for him. So I went to Niagara Falls, and that was like my first job. Where he, I don't think I got paid, but, you know, there was a director. Because I had never, it wasn't like I said, I want to be a cinematographer. It was never even like I said, I wanted to be a director. I just like making these little movies. And I think I had been inculcated so deeply from Jerry O'Grady and this program into the sort of purity and sanctity of this avant-garde filmmaking that something like Last Tango in Paris to me was, you know, Hollywood commercial crap.
Marlon Brando.
I've come to revisit those ideas as an adult. But at the time, you know, it was like narrative filmmaking was, you know, that's bourgeois.
Before you mentioned that your parents were upset that you weren't going to school, your father was a really interesting psychologist who studied kind of cognitive development and specifically in symbols. And I was thinking about that and you'd mentioned your dad a couple times over the years when we've spoken, but I had read his obituary, actually, before this interview, and it talked about the work he'd done in children's capacity for symbolic and representational thought. I thought that's so interesting that we'd never talked about that. And was he a sort of champion of the creative arts? Did you grow up in a kind of household that his work spilled into? You know, was he interested in symbols with you?
No, he was a child psychologist. And one of the reasons we moved to Buffalo was because in Detroit at that time, you know, our neighborhood was in flames. I lived in the city, not in the suburbs. And we lived through, whether you call it riots or uprising, depending on your point of view, of the 67. And then he was given this opportunity to do his research because he was a teacher, but more a research psychologist in Buffalo at a Head Start program. So he started a Head Start program in Buffalo where he studied how kids learn. So there was certainly an appreciation of the arts. My father played the recorder. He loved classical music. My mother was a political scientist, but it was not an artsy household by any stretch of the imagination. It was not antagonistic toward the arts, but I think my parents clearly were strong believers in the, you know, you go to school, you go to college, you pick a profession, you keep going. And
somehow you just weren't in agreement at the time.
No, I you know, it was the 60s and the 70s, typical you know, counterculture, hippie movement, and I was rebellious. So anything that to them was revered in that way to me was bourgeois and to be rebelled against.
So somehow you
hated school.
Yeah,
which is a shame, really. But
And somehow you make it downstate from Buffalo to Manhattan.
Yeah, I was at media study in Buffalo. So I ended up there. I hated Buffalo. I didn't want to be in Buffalo. But that kept me there the first year after high school because I hadn't applied to any colleges. And my mother, of course, was, I was already living on my own for that whole year. And, but they were very, you know, they really wanted me to apply to college and I wanted to get out of Buffalo. So I applied to a bunch of colleges and it tells you how things have changed. I got into all of them and I don't know why, but instead of going to RISD or, I went to a very new experimental college called Hampshire College. And I think I really went there because they didn't make you take classes. They had really nice film equipment and they, you know, could sort of create your own program. And I figured I'd just go there and
make stuff,
movies. And because of my parents being academics, I was given a partial scholarship and I could go there very cheap. So it was very easy for me to be able to afford it and to do it. I didn't last long, but I wound up at the Whitney Museum in New York as part of their independent study program where you get to come to New York. They give you, I had a studio in the basement of an old emigrant bank building on Reed Street.
Which is now a rug store.
Yeah. You know, I went there yesterday looking for it and I'm not sure I found the right place. I think I did. There's also a Starbucks there.
I don't know if there's a Starbucks, but it's a rug shop and they use the vault downstairs.
Oh God. I wish I had gone there with you. You don't remember the number, do you? I want to say 54, but I think I'm wrong.
No, but I know the rug store.
We're gonna have to go there.
Yeah. And you were in this program with
Well, the filmmakers that were there at the time, Colleen Fitzgibbon, Richard Tobias, I don't know that any of them necessarily became household names afterwards. My studio, a year or 2 years earlier, was Catherine Bigelow's. And I didn't know this till I worked on Hurt Locker, and she asked me where my studio was, and I told her, and I was like, oh my God. So at any rate, I wound up in New York, and this is, you know, early 70s, and, you know, this was the real beginning of the sort of underground film, video, performance art. You know,
and you were making money building people's lofts.
Yeah. For a while, I was selling tickets at the Whitney, but they fired me.
Why'd you get fired?
I got fired, yeah. Yeah, I was an artist.
For a cause?
Yeah, probably. Yeah. But it was all right. It was good because it's too far uptown anyway.
Yeah.
But yeah, my brother and I, to make a living, we would renovate lofts. We would, you know, put in electricity and plumbing and walls and all this stuff. And he got really into it to the point where he stopped making art and went on for a long, successful career with a huge construction firm building things like the Yankee Stadium and the Apple headquarters. I went along for the ride to make a living while I was trying to, you know, be an artist in New York.
And also you were meeting a creative community.
An amazing creative community, yeah. I mean, you know... the vibrancy, you know, this is the days of, or even slightly before the days of like Basquiat and Julian Schnabel. And,
no, this is like early Judd and
yeah, all
Stella,
of that, yeah.
The great.
I had a friend who worked for Donald Judd and I remember him telling me this story. He says, you know, we were walking down the street and he saw this TV in the window of a store and he just went in and bought it. Like he could afford to just go in and buy it. And we were like, wow, that dude must be so rich because he bought a TV. It was, wow.
What was Soho like at the time?
Well, it was great. I mean, it was, you know, during the day there was work and workers, and at night there was nothing but us artists smoking pot and looking at each other's art. One of the first places I lived was with my brother on Spring Street. And at that time, Spring Street had nothing on it but Mike and Sam's Hero Shop. And at West Broadway, and there was a bodega. And that was about it. I mean, there was, you know, Finelli's has always been there. There's a few icons that have been there forever. But, I mean, there was nothing at night other than a handful of bars and a lot of artists, like, tripping on each other.
Yeah.
It was very cool. It was gritty. It was dangerous.
There's a sense of freedom.
They tell me. But it was, yeah, like we own the streets, you know?
And that feeling of freedom is so necessary in like foundational years of making work.
I guess. I mean, it definitely felt like you were, you know, doing something from the grassroots up. Like you were, you know, you were building something as a community. It wasn't like you were coming into, you know, a longstanding institutional community.
And then
community.
In like 78, you go to Nicaragua. How do you get to Nicaragua?
Well, I started going to Central America around that time. The first time, was it the first time? I think the first time I went was on a documentary about Todos Santos, Cuchimatan, which is a little village in the northwest of Guatemala, where we did a documentary about the way the indigenous population was being transformed. And it was the very beginning of the it wasn't really the beginning, it was actually the middle of the guerrilla war in Guatemala and the attempt by the Guatemalan military to really eradicate the indigenous population. And right before that, I had met a woman named Pamela Yates, and I met her when I was like 19 and fell totally in love. She had, after high school, gone to South America and learned Spanish and worked as a photojournalist for El Excelsior and traveled all over Latin America. She was this exotic political, you know, brave character that I thought was younger than me because she looked so young, and found out she was actually older than me. And she really brought me into documentary filmmaking because I think I had had sort of this political influence from growing up in the 60s in Detroit, but she really brought it into a level of social activism with documentaries. So I kind of transitioned with her into doing documentaries, and they were, of course, you know, what you would call social change documentaries and stuff. And we formed a company in New York called Skylight Pictures, which still exists to this day. We had a third partner who was an editor. I was camera. I actually taught her how to do sound. This was before, like, we were a boyfriend, girlfriend or anything, because I thought maybe then she'd be my girlfriend if she did the sound and I did camera on people's movies. And again, I still wasn't thinking of myself as a cinematographer or even really like a director. It was more, because I came out of the art world, it was more like an artist. Like you create, you make things, you don't label your job category. But clearly I was drawn more to the visual and just naturally became the cinematographer. And Peter was already an editor. He was older than either of us, and sort of more grounded. And now Pam was doing sound, but really sound eventually became her stepping stone into directing, producing, creating. And, you know, we spent 12 years together. She continues to be my best friend, but we've since found our true loves. She's happily married and living in Brooklyn with now the new third partner of Skylight, new as in the last 20 years. And, you know, I'm living in Los Angeles and happily married and with kids. So we kind of moved back into our sort of the place where we came from a little more, me maybe more just a purely creative artsy, although obviously with an affinity to things that, you know, content that has a social activism aspect to it. And she's still making documentaries.
I mean, you were the first to film the Contras.
Yes, we were. So, and it's funny because I'm working with Doug Lyman this week, and Doug did this really interesting movie called Made in America, which was about a story of when Richard Hasenfuss was shot down ferrying illegal shipments to help the Contras in Nicaragua. And I don't think Doug knew about, and he found out that I had made this initial foray into Nicaragua, and we sort of exposed the story of the Contras. I mean, it was a well-kept secret, but they had never been filmed before.
How did you get access?
It's a long story, but here I'll start with, in Los Angeles, we had met Haskell Wexler, a legendary political filmmaker, legendary cinematographer, Oscar-winning cinematographer, who was known as a very liberal, or in those days he would have been considered radical, filmmaker. And he was a cinematographer, but he had done a movie called Medium Cool, and he wanted to do another feature, and he wanted to do it about Nicaragua. And he had a script, and he had seen documentaries that Pam and I had made, and he found us, and he said, you know, I'm doing this movie about Nicaragua. I got the script, and he showed us the script, and it was about the time during Somoza, and we thought, you know, Hollywood always does movies about political situations in the past. Why don't you do one about what's going on now? What's going on now is there's this secret war to overthrow the Sandinistas. And so Haskell started rethinking his movie. And there was, at that time, the Honduran and U.S. military were going to be doing one of their first ever joint military exercises on the Honduran-Nicaraguan border. And the only reason they were doing it was to scare the Sandinistas. And Haskell said to Pam and I, he said, I can get $10,000. You should go down and film this military exercise. And we can use all of the stuff you film of the helicopters and tanks and parachutists as sort of second unit material, because we'll never be able to afford to get that on our movie. So we were like, great. So we used old, outdated CBS credentials we had had from a previous shoot. We got ourselves in there. We filmed the military exercise. And when it was over, we said, we can't just go back. We've got to find these Contras, because they were hidden. They're all along the border in Honduras, but, you know, deeply hidden. So we drove up and down the border trying to get in, and we would get as far as like a guy on a dirt road leaning against a pickup truck, and he would, you know, no hay contras aquí. They just say, there's no contras here. No, there's nothing here. And we kind of go like, well, why do you have those AK-47s in the back of the pickup truck? And oh, no, we're just farmers, we're just refugees, just, but you can't go back there. And so it went on like this, and finally we made contact with a guy, Edgar Chamorro, and he agreed to meet us in Florida. So we went to Florida and we had dinner with Edgar Chamorro, and Pam was very young and very pretty, and he was a huge flirt, and I don't even know if he noticed that I was there. That's fine, because he was so enamored of her that he gave us not only permission to film with them, but he hooked us up with the necessary channels. We went back to Honduras and walked over the border from Honduras into Nicaragua with the Contra Patrol, and we filmed them in their camps and in their bases in Nicaragua. There's a good chance that it was not only our brilliance, but that they had decided for whatever reason they wanted to go public. To this day, I'm not sure how much of which it was, but for whatever reason, we were in the right place at the right time. And we came back and made a couple little short news pieces that went on CBS. It was a big expose of, you know, the first time the Contras had ever been filmed.
And then this somehow led to you DPing your first film properly.
Well, yeah. Then what happened was Pam and I went to, after we filmed with the Contras, spent a couple months doing that, then went back to Managua, and we said to the Sandinistas, we'd like to film with you guys. We filmed with the Sandinistas, and we went to the same places we had been with the Contras, but with Sandinista military patrols. And we had now literally seen a war from both sides, which is really, really rare. To this day, you know, it's very hard to like go with the Syrian, you know, Free Army and then go with the Syrian military.
I mean, Jeremy Scahill was probably one of the few that did that with Dirty Wars.
Yeah.
You know, but we almost never see two sides to any story today.
Very, very hard.
This is context.
From a first-person perspective.
Yeah, and context is everything if you want to get to the truth, and that's what we're lacking today.
Yeah.
And you presented an idea of context in that project.
Well, yeah, I mean, we really tried, you know, as much as we had our certainly political persuasion, we really tried to see a reality from both sides of a dividing line. And that's what led that documentary and our experiences there is what led Haskell to rewrite his script and offer me the job to shoot my first feature, which I was totally unqualified for. But it was that was my real film school. You know, I didn't get to go to AFI or USC.
But you DP'd a film for one of the most iconic DPs in film history.
Yeah, it was terrifying.
And also an intimidating character from many accounts.
Yeah.
So what was that like to kind of work for this, to not have the prep?
Well, it was, I think I was so young and naive and arrogant that it could have been worse, but it was actually amazing. It literally was my film school. I was there close to a year. And Haskell, the first couple of days that we were shooting was a little tough because I think Haskell was a little afraid of having to deal with the actors, and he wound up sort of getting involved in the very heavily involved in the camera. But I could see, and I don't know where I picked this up because I knew nothing about acting. I had done a few little narrative things, but not much. I mean, I had some exposure, but not a lot. And I had worked as a camera operator on some fiction stuff, but Haskell, I could see the actors getting antsy. And I remember saying to him, I said, Haskell, you know, you got to talk to the actors. You got to deal with them, you know. And then he backed off from the cinematography almost to a point where anytime I tried to do what I thought you were supposed to do, you know, a little fancier, a little more feature filmmaking, he would always say, you know, don't fuck with Mother Nature. And, you know, I was always afraid of slowing him down. I never wanted him to think like, oh, this would be so much easier if I just did it myself, which it probably would have. So ironically, I didn't really learn about like lighting, stuff like that, to the extent that, you know, I thought maybe I should have or would have. But I learned so much about so many other things, just storytelling and camera, you know, how to let things evolve from one character to another. And I think I didn't really realize it until my next narrative job, when all of a sudden I found myself doing stuff. I went like, oh, you know, I got that from Haskell.
Which was, you then were working a bit for Bob Richardson.
No, what happened after that, so I finished Latino. That was what the movie was called. And went back to New York. And I did some small little, like, you know, American Playhouse kind of things, still did documentary. But my experience with Bob Richardson and Oliver Stone started when I was sent this script called Platoon. And all I knew about Oliver Stone was that he wrote this movie, Year of the Dragon, which so many people thought was very racist. And he did Midnight Express, which other people thought was terribly, like, you know, xenophobic. And I didn't even know exactly what I was doing. I was still had my company doing documentaries. And initially I said, no, I don't want to do this. It was for second unit for hours. And Oliver called me. I was in New York and he said, there's going to be a press screening of a movie called Salvador. Go see it and then give me a call. So now I'm going to back the story up. Right after I had worked on a movie called El Salvador and Other Vietnam, I came back to New York, and literally, I think it was the next day or 2 days later, a man showed up at my office named Jeff Harmon asking me if I wanted to do a documentary in El Salvador about the aesthetics of the right and the aesthetics of the left. He had a skull and crossbone hanging around his neck. He showed me pictures in Hustler magazine of a story he did about the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. And we had just gotten back like the day before. And Pam was across the room kind of wagging her finger like, nah, don't. She was convinced everybody was in the CIA. Strange dude. And I was like, you know what, man? I would love to do it, but we just got back. We can't really do it. So that's the end of the Jeff Harmon story. Until I open up a magazine, the American Cinematographer magazine, I see an advertisement, and it says, cinematographer Robert Richardson on the front lines of El Salvador with Burns and Sawyer cameras. And I was like, who is Robert Richardson? I never heard of any guy. I knew all the photojournalists there because I was in Central America. I'd done many movies there, but as a photojournalist. So, you know, I knew them. I knew the guys that you would run into at the, you know, press conferences, at the various events. No idea who this guy was. Well, it turns out he was a guy that went to AFI and did this movie that I had said no to with Jeff Harmon in El Salvador. Flash forward a little bit, and there's a fellow at AFI named Juan Ruiz Anchia who's going to shoot Oliver Stone's. He had done the movie called The Hand, but this is really like his first feature. It's going to be about the war in El Salvador. And Juan Ruiz is going to shoot it. But then Juan Ruiz gets offered another job for Jamie Foley called A Close Range. So he says, Oliver, you should look at this film a classmate of mine did in El Salvador. It's really good. The movie that I didn't do for Jeff Harmon. So Oliver looks at it and hires this guy, Robert Richardson, to shoot Salvador, Robert Richardson's first movie. I think it was his first movie. So now it's a year or two later, whatever it is, and I'm being asked to go see this press conference. And Latino was an amazing experience for Pam and I, but it wasn't a good movie. And in part because Haskell felt the compulsion that it had to be more commercial. And he put elements in it that I think really undercut it. And let's face it, he wasn't the writer that Oliver Stone is. So we go see this movie, Pam and I, Salvador, and I'm blown away by it. She's next to me, of course, being the purist, like, oh, it's not really like that or whatever, like that, you know. But I think this is amazing. I literally walked out the door, called Oliver, and I went, all right, you know, I'll do this platoon thing. And I flew to the Philippines where I met this guy named Robert Richardson, Bob. And then we started talking and we realized we were born 2 days apart. His wife was a documentary filmmaker. She was actually the one, I believe, if I have the story right, that pushed both Oliver and Bob to watch my documentaries, which is essentially what got me the job. And I went to do Platoon, and that was the first of several movies I did with Oliver and a lifelong relationship with Bob.
Wall Street, The Doors.
Yeah, Wall Street, The Doors. I worked a little bit on Nixon, and I can't remember them all. But
with The Doors, you actually shot that amazing sequence in the desert.
No, that was Bob.
You were there, though, on that day.
No.
In the desert.
I did. Oh, actually, no, I wasn't in the desert, but the funny story on The Doors.
I'm remembering a story.
Here's the story on The Doors that is really bizarre. So I finished a movie. Sounds like the Spike Lee story. I finished a movie on a Sunday with a director named Greg Hoblit. And Greg is a very, he likes things very controlled, very specific, very, very kind of, you know, intentional, shall we say. And I come home, I'm sound asleep, and I get a phone call from Bob Richardson in the middle of the night, and he says, Monona's water broke. You have to fill in for me today. And his second child was about, what is his first? Was his first? Second? Oh, man, I have to go to IMDb to remember. But he goes, here's the address. Be there at like 5 a.m. or whatever it was in Trancas out in Malibu. So I get in the car. I'm still asleep. I'm driving out. I'm going to fill in for him. And I'm remembering that we had, you know, he was doing The Doors. I'd never read the script, but we talked a bunch about it and even had like a sort of Doors mezcal drinking trip to Catalina beforehand. But I get to the set and I realize it's day one of shooting. This is their first day of shooting and I'm being asked to take over the movie. So I start shooting and I've got Oliver now standing next to me, like in my ear going, yeah, pan left. No, go to the drummer. It was the scene where they were, the first scene I did was the one where they were writing Light My Fire. And it's madness. It's Oliver Stone madness. You know, cameras swishing everywhere. And I got lights and shot. And it was a really, I hadn't read the script. I mean, I knew the music. I loved the band. But I was literally this major motion picture, bigger than anything I'd ever worked on, with movie stars like Meg Ryan, doing like Meg Ryan's first close-up. And, you know, it's literally like thrown from your bed into the lion's den. So, yeah, that's how I started the Doors.
And what, you know, it's a good time to kind of talk about this. How would you define the role of DP or cinematographer? I mean, what is it really for people that kind of see it?
What a cinematographer does is really, people ask that a lot, you know, and it's very specific and very vague. I mean, ultimately, you're the director of photography, right? You're controlling the image. That's theoretically what you're doing. You're recording the image. You're photographing it. Okay. But what that means can be so variable depending upon the nature of the movie and the relationship with the director. And I've worked for directors that are, you know, wouldn't know one end of the camera from the other, and ones that tell you this is the lens I want right here. So, I mean, you know, the textbook way is that you're responsible for the movement of the camera, the lighting of the scene, and the composition of the frame, that all of those things come under your purveyance. But how they do and in what way they do can have a radically different processes. And you'll see that in cinematographers, where there are those who see themselves as an artist and they have a style and a look. And when they're given a job, they figure out how to adapt that job to their style. And then there are those that are more sort of freewheeling, shall we say, and take on a project and their style evolves and
I mean,
morphs.
I can't think of a style of your style.
Right. I have no style. And it's interesting because, you know,
by design, you have no style. This is,
well,
I mean, it's not your interest.
It's, I have a short attention span. And I think I see every new movie as a new opportunity to do something that I haven't done before. Having said that, I think what you find as you get older and you have done more work, that you do have more of a style than you realize, because you have instincts. And at one point or another, no matter how much you prep and plan, you're going to follow your instincts. And your instincts will have a voice, you know, for better or worse. So, yeah, I think I've enjoyed creating work that is radically different from other work that I've done. And then you can see, you know, other cinematographers like a Storaro or somebody who has a very specific kind of approach. And, you know, it's interesting because Bob Richardson did for quite a while. I think his work has evolved and changed, but, you know, he was known for a long time for these really hot, blown out top lights and stuff like that. So I
feel like your interest has always been story, and the choices are in pushing the story along.
Yeah, and the politically correct thing you're supposed to say is that, you know, you don't impose your style on the film, that that the story is what drives everything, and that you service the story, and if you notice the camera work, you're not doing your job. That's what you're supposed to say, because that's what gets you the next job. And there's an element of truth to it, you know. And then there are those movies that want the style to be front and center, and then there are those movies that really, they do want the style to take a back seat. You know, that form and content have a constant dialectic in cinema, that and it's form and content sometimes have a love affair, and sometimes one of them wins. And usually when one wins, it's bad.
Well, your tools are incredibly powerful. I mean, the expansion and compression of time can change an emotionality.
Yeah.
Lighting, what you're revealing, what you're not. These are all tools that are incredibly powerful in terms of the emotions that they express. One film I think about a lot was the film you shot, I think, in 95, The Usual Suspects, which another moment in your life that sort of pivoted into a whole run of things. Was that your only offer at the time? Were there other things? How did you choose that film?
It probably was my only offer. You know, I chose it really because they offered it to me. Yeah. And, you know, it had good actors in it. And it was this sort of young, brazen director that seemed like he was going to go places. And I did it.
Did you realize at the time it would be such an important film?
No. No, not at all. I realized that, you know, the actors were really good and the story was fun, but I was a little surprised at how it was my first film with Bryan Singer. It was really his first. He had done a sort of somewhere between a student film and a first film before that that got attention at Sundance. That's what got him Usual Suspects. And he was only, I think he was 26 or something at the time. And Chris McQuarrie had written this amazing script. I was amazed at the confidence that he had and yet how much sort of the prep and the structure of shooting the film I had to do on my own because he didn't really prep. And I didn't know that much about film, but I had done enough movies that, like I had done a movie in Alaska with a director where we shotlisted every shot and we worked it all out and it was great. And that's, it was a German director and my mother was German. So like, that's sort of, you know, I work both ways, but I like it when you actually know what you're going to do. So my first day of prep, I went over to Brian's house and I opened up my script and I tried to shotlist with him. And an hour into it, I realized I hadn't gotten one shot and it was like never going to happen. And I just kind of closed the script up and said, well, I guess I'm on my own. And then he invited me to his birthday party, which was coming up in a few days. And I said, sure. And I came back to his, he had two roommates in a house on, and he was, remember, he's in his mid-20s, 26, I think. And I come to his house and there was like 400 people at his house. And I was like, my God, this guy's like in his mid-20s. He's like this phenomena already. I don't know if it's a cinematic phenomena or what it is, but he's something.
Social phenomena.
Whatever it was. I mean, it was amazing, you know? And I'll never forget that our first day of shooting, producers brought us into the trailer. And afterwards, he had a trailer. Never heard about that. And they raked us over the coals because we had shot a little over 5,000 feet of film. And, or, you know, it was like one roll more than we were budgeted for or something. And I was just thinking, like, my God, this is the guy's first movie. And the way you're supporting him is by telling him he shot too much film.
Yeah.
So at any rate, you know, we found our sort of symbiosis, what his strengths were and what mine were, and they came together, and that was the first of 10 movies.
Superman Returns, X-Men.
Yeah. I did 4 X-Men Valkyrie. Movies with them. Valkyrie, Our Pupil, you know, Jack the Giant Killer. You know, when I look back, I mean, the X-Men movies, the first X-Men movie, really, I think was a very important movie culturally in terms of what it brought to that, to the concept of a superhero movie or a comic book movie, which wasn't really a genre in quite the same way, nothing like it is today, that also clearly had a kind of larger social message underneath it.
Which linked to your early work. I found that very interesting, this sort of...
Yeah.
You know, what is the relationship between these sort of true human stories from your early career and the big spectacle movies is that there is a humanism. There is a desire to pull out something human.
Yeah. And I think, you know, for me, today, I think everybody talks about it as obvious, but you know, it wasn't maybe quite as obvious at the beginning, but the minute I read the script, to me, it was a story of the cultural polemic between Martin Luther King and Malcolm X. That's what the movie was. For Brian, it might have been more, you know, as a gay director, it might have been more, you know, an allegory for where we were beginning to go as a society in terms of acceptance of, you know, sexual preference. So, you know, as somebody that was always oriented and gravitated more toward more films that were more content driven, I think that was sort of my way of, you know, rationalizing that I was doing something valuable or worthwhile.
Well, before that, I mean, you had, let's not skip over my favorite of anything you've been involved with, which was Three Kings, which when I watched that film, I was shocked.
But that was after that.
Was it after? I thought Three Kings was before.
No, the first X-Men was...
You made Three Kings in like at the end of the 90s.
The end of the millennium.
Yeah, your last contribution in the 20th century. Yeah.
It was a 20th century film.
Exactly. And you... One image that you took us into that I'll never forget is taking us inside the body with the bullet. How did that, was that written? Was that something that you had come up with?
No, that was all David O. Russell. It was written in the script. And, you know, how we filmed it was something that evolved. But the concept of it was right there in the script. And the actual inside of the body, I filmed on a little insert stage at Panavision. But...
What'd you use?
Oh, it was a whole prosthetic build. We didn't use a real person, you know, although.
I thought you used pig organs or something.
I don't know what. No, I'm pretty sure it was all just, you know, silicone and goop and stuff.
But this is one of those moments that took a, that showed us something real that we couldn't have seen without that medium.
Yes, that's correct.
And what the film's also famous for, which brings up your sort of fearlessness as an artist, is the bleach process, the look of that film. Mm. How did that transpire? How did you get away with that?
Well, you know, David O. Russell was similar to Brian in the sense that when I went my first day prepping with him, I went to his office, opened up my script, and a few hours in, had gotten nowhere. And we sort of talked more ephemerally. And the constructive thing that came out of it was really that he wanted me to shoot some tests. So I did. And that was actually how I was able to communicate with him at that stage in terms of shooting stuff. And he looked at it and saying, yeah, no, yeah, no. And I got to, I don't know what it was, but I felt that I wanted this to create a feeling of these guys being in this desert, in this bubble of the military base. And then this kind of mind-blowing perceptual experience when they leave the military base. And now four guys are, for the first time, in the real world of Iraq, amongst the people, like without the shelter of a hole. So I had used cross-processing before on small pieces of other films, but I thought I wanted to do almost all of this film cross-process.
But somehow you convinced the studio without knowing if the film would deteriorate.
So I did the tests and I decided that I wanted to do a skip bleach negative, not in the print, but in the negative. So it's built right, which is much more radical for the opening. And then as soon as they leave the base, I wanted to go to cross-process. So we had to get the studio to approve it. And at that time, Lorenzo de Bonaventura was the head of Warner Brothers. So I took my test and David and I went to the theater at Warner Brothers and we sat down. I had never met Lorenzo. Lorenzo walks into the theater, sits down next to me and just signals for the projectionist to start the film. And he starts the film. And it's a really balls out look, especially in those days. I'm starting to think like, what else have I been offered? Because I'm going to get fired. This test is going to end. The lights are going to come on and I'm going to get fired. So I really got to think about what other jobs I can get because I need a job. So test ends, the lights come on, and Lorenzo turns and he looks not at David, but at me. And he says, well, if you think you can make this movie look like one cogent whole, one unified piece, go ahead. And it just blew my mind. I was like, did the head of Warner Brothers just tell me to go ahead and shoot a movie cross process? Because you have to understand that it meant that the dailies had to be, that we had to buy, it was still film. It wasn't even movie film. It was still film, reversal film. We had to have Kodak make it for us. We had to buy it ahead of time. We had to sign a waiver that said Kodak was not responsible for anything that happened. We had to send the film from where we were shooting back to Los Angeles to be developed at a little like mom and pop boutique lab.
Bathtub processing.
And we had to shoot film that was so profoundly improperly developed that if your exposure was off a half a stop, you were shit out of luck. If you came to the set of Three Kings, you would have thought I was shooting Hawaii 5-0 or something. It was so surreal.
But it was atmosphere and tone, which is what I'm getting at, which you've used as a very powerful tool in a lot of your films. In the last couple of minutes, I wanted to talk a bit about Drive, which was the other very atmospheric film that had huge cultural resonance at the time, which was another moment where you chose a kind of look and feel that was somewhat radical. What were you thinking about in terms of that film, and why did you make the choices?
Well, Drive was directed by Nicholas Winding Refn, whose previous movies had been done in Denmark, with one in London that he did with Tom Hardy and called Bronson. And that's the movie that really made me want to work with him. And Drive, you know, Nick is a very singular character and very bold character, you know, far more bold than me. So it was really, there was a pace and a kind of lyrical quality that I knew he wanted in the movie, at the same time as it was a movie about driving, about speed, about, you know, that had these action, tense action moments, and yet whose central character was silent and nonverbal. And so it was a way of creating a look and a feel that both serviced the sort of dramatic tension side and yet let things breathe and let things take time, and gave a signature to each one of the car sequences that had its singularity, so that they were all very different from each other. They all had a different language. So the challenge was to balance these two seemingly opposing qualities into something that, again, you know, all worked in unison. And, you know, it was hard because there's car chases have been shot to death.
Somehow you brought something new to that.
And we really looked at, you know, how can we had no second unit. We had no, you know, it was a very low budget movie. And it was Nick's first movie in Hollywood. And as such, I felt this sort of compulsion that I should get him maybe a little more coverage than he might want, because I thought, I love what we're doing, but I know the financiers are going to make him tighten this thing up. And here's what is so amazing about Nick, is that in the end, when he did his cut, there was two financiers. And indeed, one of them was like, oh, it's too long, it's too slow, it's too this. And the other one was, no, we're going to support the director. And I was amazed at how much he was able to stay true to the pace and the rhythm that he wanted for the movie. And I really admire how he stuck to his guns. And it, you know, everybody loves that movie and it won the prize at Cannes, so he must have known something.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, films seem to have a soul of their own. People talk about the sort of like film gods. And the last big piece that's been out from you is Bohemian Rhapsody, which in the press had a lot of kind of mythology and things around it. And did you think that while you were making this incredibly challenging production, that it would reach audiences in the way it did? Did it sort of have success in spite of its own evolution?
I knew that Queen had a big fan base, and the music has an even bigger fan base than the band itself. So I knew that it would reach an audience. But more importantly, I knew that Rami Malek was doing something magical, that I was watching magic.
Yeah.
And because of some of the, you know, the difficulties of the production, I was privileged to actually be even more front and center than a cinematographer usually is with an actor. So I knew there was magic there. And whether it would all come together like lightning in a bottle, as the great movies do, you never know. But I for all the troubles the movie had in production, every day of that movie, I loved going to work. I loved it. I loved shooting it. I loved watching Rami and the rest of the guys. But, I mean, he was just absolutely extraordinary.
Well, you've had a lot of amazing experiences getting to do what you do. You've had a very special life.
Yeah, blessed. Really am blessed.
It's been such a treat to have you on today. I've been wanting to do this for a long time. Thank you so much for sharing with us.
It feels so formal. It's like, it's my buddy. You can't see it, all you podcasters. But anyway, keep listening to Andrew Zuckerman, because he only talks to interesting people, with this exception.
Thank you so much. Thanks for listening. You can find more episodes of the Time Sensitive Podcast on our website, timesensitive.fm, or on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. You can follow us on Instagram at slowdown.tv.